He took three boxes of 9mm in both hollow point and full metal jacket and stacked those with the magazines.
"I don't have any assault rifles," Pop said, eyeing his rifles.
"What's accurate and easy to load?"
"Well, the Remington 700's a tack driver if there ever was one," Pop said. "It's not a fast reloader, but not too slow either. It's a 270, and I have a couple hundred rounds for it."
"Is it scoped?"
"Yes," Pops replied.
"Good. We may have to reach out and touch someone."
Pops smiled, but it was a rigid, tense smile. He was clearly hoping that it didn't come to that. He was a man who loved to shoot, but preferred the ring of a steel target over the scream of a human one. They ferried weapons, ammo, and assorted items for the rest of the day until everything was unloaded and stashed away. By that time, everyone was starving. Ellen already had dinner heating on the grill prior to their arrival, so throwing it together only took a few minutes. Nana and Ariel helped. Pete walked Pops around, showing him some of the things they'd done with Jim gone. 20 minutes later, they were seated outside eating pork roast, noodles, fresh broccoli, and biscuits.
"The disaster sure hasn't impaired your abilities to put together a meal," Pop said enthusiastically.
Ellen smiled. Pops loved food.
"We camp so much that cooking outdoors is second nature," Ellen said. "We're also eating a little higher on the hog right now because we have so much in the refrigerator that needs to be eaten. We have some beef roasts, too, that I might slice into jerky and dehydrate if we can't eat them fast enough."
"There's a roast or two in our coolers also," Nana said.
"If we can slice and marinate some of that tonight, I'll start drying it tomorrow," Ellen said. "It'll keep longer that way."
"What else needs doing around here?" Pops asked. "Anything Pete and I could be doing?"
"Jim left us a manual," Ellen said.
Pops chuckled. "That boy was always more organized than anyone else I ever knew," he said with admiration.
"Well, the manual gives us a few ideas and tells us what materials he stored that we may be able to use to increase security around the property."
Pops started to say something else, but paused when they all became aware of a distant clanging sound. It was a steady, metallic banging. Ellen rose first, followed by Pops. She went in the house and unlocked and opened the front door. Looking through the storm door, she could see a cluster of people at the front gate, beating on it with a stick. There were two ATVs and what looked like four people standing there by the gate. Nana looked puzzled.
"I wonder what they want."
"Only one way to find out," Ellen said.
"You're going down there?" Pops asked.
"What else am I supposed to do? If I ignore them, they'll probably cross the gate and come up. I don't want them up here seeing what we have."
"How do you propose we do this?" Pops asked.
Ellen was glad that he used the word "we."
"I'm going to drive down there in my car," Ellen replied. "I'll wear this sidearm and make sure it's visible. I'm also going to carry Jim's tactical shotgun because it's about the scariest damn gun in the house. I'd like you to ride with me, keeping a gun visible so you can cover me. I want them to see that we're ready for trouble."
Pops took a deep breath and sighed.
"Okay, let's go do this."
"I want to go," Pete said.
Ellen put her arm around him.
"You need to stay up here and take care of Nana and your sister. You can get your gun and keep it with you, but I want the chamber empty. You have to be safe with it, okay?"
Pete looked pleased with that. Guard duty was a big responsibility. Ellen and Pops retrieved their weapons and went to her SUV. Pops seemed nervous. Ellen was slightly nervous, too, but even more pissed about having people show up like this. She drove quickly to the gate, leaving a cloud of dust behind the Suburban. When she reached them, she hit the brakes and slid to a stop by the gate. She sat for a moment, sizing up the group. There were two men and two women, the entire group appearing to be older adults, maybe in their 40s. Ellen opted for the assertive approach.
"What the hell are you all doing beating on my gate?" she demanded.
The group stared at her for a moment. Then one of the women stepped forward. She was overweight and rough-looking, unkempt. Ellen figured she didn't work.
She had the look of someone used to sitting home all day doing nothing.
"We wanted to talk to you a second," the woman called down.
The woman had missing teeth and bad skin. Ellen flung her door open and climbed down. She reached back in, grabbed the shotgun, and slung it over her shoulder. Leaving the Suburban running, she stepped around the open door, stopping at the front bumper. The group looked taken aback at the weapons, staring at them.
"Then talk," Ellen said. "I've got stuff to do."
The woman cleared her throat, gathering her thoughts.
"We was wondering if you had any food to spare," the woman said. "We're about out. The whole trailer park's about out."
"There's nothing I can do for you," Ellen said. "We've got just enough for my family."
"Surely there's something you can give us," the woman said with a hint of anger.
"Like I said, we've only got enough for my family," Ellen said. "We're not rich people sitting on a pile of food. We were taken by surprise just like you all were. Now you're expecting us to feed the whole damn trailer park?"
It was clear to Ellen that the woman was used to getting handouts, used to government checks, rental vouchers, all the benefits awarded to those too sorry to work. Of course, she knew that there were people who legitimately couldn't work for various health reasons. But there was also a whole culture dependent on being coddled and taken care of. They were not her problem. Her concern was with her children, her parents and in-laws, and her husband that she missed terribly. She fought to control her anger.
"So you ain't gonna give us nothing?" the woman asked. "What are we supposed to do?"
"I just made it clear to you that I have nothing to give," Ellen said. "We have a little food for ourselves, but I don't know how far it'll get us. I cannot give anything away. As far as what you're supposed to do, I suggest you get out and start looking. See if there's someone needing work done. Do some hunting. There's still time to set out a garden."
It was obvious that the idea of having to do any work wasn't setting well with the woman.
"Well, that ain't good enough," the woman yelled.
"And you ain't my damn problem," Ellen yelled back, bristling.
"Fucking rich bitch," one of the men said under his breath, loud enough for Ellen to hear.
"We can be your problem if that's the way you want to play it."
Ellen whipped the shotgun off her shoulder in a flash and leveled it at the man, racking around into the chamber.
"Let me make this crystal clear," Ellen said, her words firm. "I have nothing for you. I am not responsible for taking care of you. The best thing you can do is get the hell out of here and never darken my doorstep again."
One of the men spoke, and she realized it was one of the men from earlier that morning, one of the rabbit hunters.
"This here's a public road," he said. "Ain't no law against us being on a public road."
Ellen met his eye.
"No, there isn't," she said. "But my suggestion to you is that you stay on it and stay on that side of this gate."
"Or what?"
the man asked belligerently, jutting his jaw out defiantly.
"Let's just say that my husband has an excavator that digs a hole 11 feet deep, and I have access to hundreds of acres where I can dig holes. Anyone crosses that gate, they'll never be seen again."
"You got the balls to kill a man?"
"I don't recommend you find out," Ellen said. "You might not like the answer."
With that, Ellen backed up, got in her vehicle, and slammed the door. She laid the shotgun across the center console and accelerated backward, executing a perfect bootlegger turn in the gravel driveway. In her rearview mirror, she could see the people still standing in the road, awash in the cloud of dust that she left behind.
"That went well,"
Pops said sarcastically.
"If you hadn't been with me, and if we hadn't have been armed, I think they might have tried to make their way up to the house."
"You really think so?"
"I do," Ellen said. "If they only wanted sympathy, they would have just sent the women, hoping we could talk it out woman to woman. By the men coming too, I think the idea was to try force if diplomacy failed."
They pulled back in front of the house, and Ellen killed the engine.
"What now?"
Pops asked.
"I think we need to set out some tripwires and barricades before dark. We may even have to pull some guard duty tonight just to keep an eye on things."
Chapter 16.
The Bear Den shelter was a large three-sided structure made of the type of milled logs used in log home construction. It had an overhang on the front that covered a porch. The porch, as well as the picnic table out front, was piled with packs and boots and assorted pieces of well-used gear. In between the piles of gear, there were tired, dirty hikers lounging around eating, drinking, and tending to blistered feet. Our approach drew little attention initially, other than hikers looking up to see if they recognized us, hoping we were a trail friend they'd encountered along the way. When they saw we weren't, they went back to what they were doing. As we got closer, though, some began to give us a second look. Our gear was obviously not standard backpacking gear, and we were cleaner than the norm. "Let's take a break here," I said, as we neared the shelter. Randy and Gary hung back a little, but as a veteran of many AT section hikes, I was comfortable with shelters and hikers. I mean, really, they were backpackers, not a street gang. They may stink, but they weren't scary. I approached the picnic table and dropped my pack on the ground. "How's it going?" I asked the man and woman who were already seated at the table. The guy appeared to be in his 20s, with a thick beard, long hair, and a bandana wrapped around his head. The girl with him appeared to be about the same age, in a tie-dye shirt with brown hair worn in dreadlocks and a nose piercing. "Good, man," the guy said in a friendly tone. The girl looked at me and smiled. The guy checked me out and glanced at my companions. "You guys day hikers?" It was a typical starting point in a trail conversation, determining whether a person was a day hiker or a through hiker. "You could say that," I said. "We don't look like through hikers." He shook his head and laughed. "Not hardly." "Too clean," the girl added. "That'll change," I said. "You spend any time out here, it sure will," the guy said. Randy and Gary approached about this time and dropped their gear. Gary took a seat at the picnic table while Randy wandered back to relish another for precious cigarettes. The guy nodded to Randy's pack. "Is that a pillowcase?" Gary laughed. "Yep, she's into ultralight homemade gear." The couple at the table began to eye us a little cautiously. The girl leaned forward conspiratorially. "Are you guys like fugitives or something? I mean, if you are, that's cool and all. Just don't kill us." I laughed this time. "Not hardly," I said. "More like refugees than fugitives. We're just making our way home." "Dude, there are a lot better ways to get home than the AT," the guy said. "Like about any other way possible in the world is faster than this." Gary and I exchanged a glance. Could they not know what had happened? "How long has it been since you guys have resupplied?" I asked. The girl looked at her friend as if trying to recall. It was easy to lose track of time out here when every day revolved around walking, eating, and sleeping. "Maybe 3 days," she said. "We've got a package waiting for us tomorrow up ahead just a little. That's our next supply point." "Have you not seen anyone in the last day or so?" Gary asked. "Nobody new," the guy said. "We hiked most of the last couple of days with this group here. This is a pretty remote section of the AT, so we just stuck together. We've crossed paths with a few Sobos, but that's been it." "Sobos?" Gary asked. "Southbounders," the girl piped in, "hiking the trail from north to south. We're Nobos, northbounders." "You guys haven't heard any news from the outside?" I asked. They shook their heads in unison. I looked over at Gary again, not quite sure how to say it delicately. "Guys, things are getting crazy out there right now," I said. "There have been major terrorist attacks, and things are pretty much fucked. That's why we're not on the road." I could see Gary out of the corner of my eye, and he was grimacing. I looked over at him. "What?" I asked. "Well, that was delicate," he said. "You certainly didn't sugarcoat it." I shrugged. "What can I say? I'm plain spoken." "Hey, guys," the girl yelled, turning back toward the shelter and calling to the people inside. "What's up?" came a voice from the shelter. "Get out here," she said. "You all have to hear this." Randy had finished her cigarette and pitched the butt in the fire pit in front of the shelter. She wandered over to us. "What's going on?" she asked. "They don't know,"
Gary said to her. "Don't know what?" she asked, confused.
"Don't know about any of it," Gary told her. "I haven't seen people or heard any news in days."
Oh, shit.
There was the sound of boots on wood, and a handful of other hikers streamed from the shelter. I counted five of them, roughly around the same age as these guys. The girl turned back to me and waited expectantly.
"I was just telling your friends here that things are pretty bad out there in the world," I announced to the group. "There were over a dozen major terrorist attacks yesterday. They've knocked the power out to most of the country, blown up roads and dams, and now you can't get any gas."
The group stared at us, stunned.
"Were a lot of people killed?" the guy at the table asked. "We really don't know," I said. "I did hear a report that they blew up a dam in Kentucky, and that caused Nashville to flood. They blew up the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel and several oil refineries. It's hard to get information, so we don't know a lot. With the power outages, a lot of stations are not broadcasting anymore. Now they've frozen the gas supply and left stranded travelers all over the country with no way to get home. That's how we ended up here."
"Isn't the government doing anything to help?" one of the group from the shelter asked.
"The only thing we know for sure that the government is doing," Gary said, "is sending some buses down the interstate to gather stranded folks up and put them in emergency camps. Some of our folks went with them, but we didn't want to."
"Shit," someone in the group muttered. "That's messed up."
"Why aren't you walking on the roads?" one of the group asked. "What the hell are you doing all the way up here? The road is easy walking compared to this. Maybe you could even hitch a ride."
"It's not safe," Randy said. "The cops are all busy with emergencies, so people are pretty much doing whatever they want. There have been attacks on people walking the interstate. We've seen shootings and had to defend ourselves, too. The trouble is unavoidable if you stay down there. It's extremely dangerous."
There were other questions about specific regions of the country, presumably where these hikers had family, but they were areas we hadn't heard anything about.
"We haven't had cell reception all day," the guy at the table said. "I was hoping we'd get some today to call home. Now I'm worried about my parents."
"There's reception further up the trail," Gary said. "We didn't have any all day until about 6 miles back. There's a fire road that crosses the AT, and there's a pocket of reception there."
The guy got up from the table and started gathering his gear.
"Let's pack up," he told the girl.
"I won't be able to sleep tonight until I've at least tried to get a hold of my family."
She got up also and began gathering her gear.
"Try a text if you can't make a call," I told the guy.
"We could text, but we never could get any calls through."
"Thanks," he said.
"Sorry to dump all that bad news on you guys," I said. "I know it's a lot to take in."
The guy started shoving items in his pack.
"Are the rest of you guys going?" he asked the group that had come out of the shelter.
They looked around at each other, nodded, and went back to start gathering their own gear. One guy stuck around. He was similar to the others in appearance, scruffy, sweat-stained, and tanned.
"Where exactly are you guys headed?" he asked.
"Why?" I replied, my paranoia kicking in instantly.
"Tazewell County," Gary replied. "At least that's where I'm headed. The others live in that general area."
"My girlfriend and I are students from Emory and Henry College," he said. "She's back in the shelter packing her gear."
"We're familiar with Emory and Henry," I said. "Gary had a daughter who attended there."
"We were hiking up from Damascus," he said. "We were going to go to Shenandoah National Park and have some relatives pick us up there. Our families live in the Bristol area."
"I would head home," I said. "No telling if anyone will be able to get there to pick you up with the fuel restrictions. And even if they did, they wouldn't be able to drive you this far with no fuel. You may not even be able to get a call out to your relatives to pick you up. You may end up isolated and on your own. Not a good place to be."
"Can we hike with you?" he asked.
I expected this and had no problem with it. As a parent, I would hope that someone would help my kids in a similar situation.
"Sure," I said. "We're fresh on the trail and will probably not be able to keep your pace, though."
"That's no problem. We can slow it down for you old folks," he said with a grin.
I looked at Gary. "I'm having second thoughts already." The guy extended his hand to me.
"I'm Walt. My girlfriend is Katie."
I shook his hand.
Then he shook with Gary, waving to Randy, who was a little further back.
"Pack your stuff," I told him, "and we need to eat a bite, so give us a few minutes."
He nodded and wandered off to tell his girlfriend of their new plans. Gary, Randy, and I shared a quick meal of jerky, crackers, and water. We bid goodbye to the departing hikers as they hastily moved out, taking large strides to gain more ground with each step. Walt and Katie said their goodbyes to their trail friends and exchanged contact info so they could get in touch at a later point.
"So that's what I'm going to smell like when I get home?" Randy asked.
I nodded. "Maybe even worse," I said. She shook her head at the repugnant thought.
"It keeps the bugs away," Walt assured her.
"And everyone else," Gary added. By my GPS, we averaged 2.5 miles per hour over the next 3 hours of walking, which did indeed gain us a few additional miles before feeling the need to stop for the night. As the sun fell over the horizon and our weariness grew, the sound of insects and night birds began to emerge. Walt and Katie dropped their packs when we selected a frequently used group campsite for the night.
"Do you guys even have any gear?" Katie asked.
She was an athletic, smallish waif of a girl with short hair. We'd learned over the course of the past few miles that she was a triathlete who'd competed throughout the world. She carried her 50-pound pack like it was nothing.
"Some," I replied. "We have a tent," she replied. "I kind of feel bad about sleeping in a tent with warm sleeping bags while you guys are roughing it."
"No worries," Gary said. "We'll be okay. Use the gear you have and be glad you have it." Walt and Katie found a good tent site and set up their camp quickly and efficiently. You could tell they'd done this many times. One rolled out a protective ground cloth while another dug the tent out. One rolled out the tent while the other dug out poles. Before you knew it, they'd assembled their camp, said goodnight, and climbed in for the night.
"I know you told me we'd have to rough it if we passed up the shelter," Randy said. "But how the hell are we going to sleep out here? I mean, I've camped before, but not like this. I had actual camping stuff. What do I need to do?"
I dropped my pack and looked at Gary. "What do you have in the way of shelter?" I asked.
"I've got a tarp and a piece of painter's plastic," he said.
"I've got a tarp and a piece of Tyvek house wrap," I said. "Between your items and mine and a little paracord, we can throw up a quick shelter."
"What do you need me to do?" Randy asked.
I was impressed that she was eager to help. I knew she was not used to this level of activity, spending most of her time at a desk and not really having any physical hobbies. She had to be exhausted. We were all tired, though, and the job would go faster with more hands.
"Gather some leaves," Gary said. "Find a forked stick and use it to rake leaves into a square pile about 8 feet by 8 feet. Make it about a foot thick and pick out any big sticks from it. If Jim doesn't mind, we can put his Tyvek over that and it'll give us a soft bed. We'll string one of our tarps over top of it to ward off any dew or overnight rain."
With a plan in place, we all went to work with the same weary efficiency that Walt and Katie had demonstrated earlier. In about 20 minutes, we had a functional shelter. I had planned to eat a little more and drink another bottle of water, but that went out the window when we completed the shelter and all sat under it for a test drive. Within seconds, we were all fumbling with the purloined hotel blankets and covering ourselves. I put my pack at my head and used one soft corner of it for a pillow. I could feel my pistol poking me in the side, and I started to remove the holster and slide it under the pack, but I was asleep before I could complete the action. At some point in the night, I thought I heard the sound of an ATV nearby, but I couldn't be sure if it was real or if I dreamed it. I rolled over and went back to sleep. Chapter 17. Working until darkness closed around them, Ellen, Pops, and Pete strung a series of tripwires around the house. There would be 3 rings of tripwires that any trespasser would have to get through to make it to the house. Those farthest from the house used the fishing line because they had more of it than anything else. Attached to the fishing line were clip-on bells from the fishing aisle at Walmart, strings of cans that would rattle together, and even a set of wind chimes from the back porch. Anything that would make a noise that the person on watch would hear.
The next two rings utilized Mason's twine and party poppers. Someone activating one of these tripwires would set off a small firework that would give us a very loud notification of an intruder. Hopefully it would startle the visitor also and perhaps send them running the other way. Ellen would do the first watch tonight, Pete the second, and Pops would take over in the early morning. They planned to try that arrangement for the night and see how it worked. They could always switch the arrangements if it didn't. Ellen's shift went without any hitches. She moved from the front porch to the back and walked around the house several times. The night was warm and quiet. At one point, coyotes began yipping and howling in the distance. Rather than being scared by the sound, she was always thrilled by it. It was part of why she loved living in the country so much. When her shift ended, she gave the yard one last scan with the night vision and went to wake Pete up. When she was sure Pete was fully awake and not going to pass out in the porch swing, she went over the basics with him. She hung the night vision monocular over his head and made sure he knew how to use it. "I've used it before, Mom," he said, "several times." "Just checking," she said. "This is important work. We're all depending on you. You're such a big boy now." She leaned over and kissed him on the head, then gave him the shotgun, showing him that there was now a round in the chamber and that it was ready to fire when the safety was turned off. She went over this in great detail, even though she knew Pete had a lot of gun experience for someone his age, knowing that repetition was how things became committed to memory, even if it was irritating. "Remember how loud this'll be if you shoot it," she reminded him. "Don't be startled. Just make sure you have a firm grip on it so that it doesn't kick the fire out of you." Pete nodded. "If you have things under control, I'm going to bed," Ellen said. "I do, Mom," he told her. "I'll be fine." And he was fine. For most of his shift, that was. It was around 2:30 a.m. when the tinkle of a bell, followed by a hissed curse, told him that someone had found the first ring of tripwires. From his dark perch on the front porch, Pete quietly raised the night vision monocular to his eye and looked out in the direction of the bell. He could clearly make out two men walking toward the house through a field to his left. They were not men he recognized. He could see well enough to know that neither man was his father. One man was carrying something in his hand that may have been a pistol, but it was hard to tell. Neither man had any sort of long gun. Pete started to go wake Ellen and Pops. He stood, and the porch creaked beneath his feet. He took another step, and there was another creak. His heart rate accelerated. He could feel the fringes of panic. He knew that his own sound was broadcasting through the silence of the night as clearly as the bell had. He turned back toward the field without moving his feet and took another glance through the monocular. The men were closer now, crouched low and moving quickly across the damp grass. They would be on him soon. Pete dropped the monocular back to his chest and took another step toward the door to the house. There was another creak of boards beneath his feet. How had he never noticed before that the porch was so loud? Another step, and he could hear the men talking, whispering back and forth. He took another step and reached in the darkness for the door handle. He knew he was close, knew the handle was just outside his reach. He felt tears burning down his cheeks, and his breathing increased. He wanted to run, but had a job to do. A bang behind him scared him nearly to death. In his panic, he could not tell if it was one of the party poppers or if one of the men had opened fire on him. He spun and clicked the safety to the fire position, pointed the muzzle of the shotgun toward the last sound he'd heard in the darkness, and fired. The fire erupting from the short shotgun barrel temporarily blinded him, just as the noise from the blast set his ears ringing. When he recovered, he could hear a man screaming.
"Shit, Mike, you okay?" the voice said. "Mike, get up!"
Pete snapped to attention and racked the slide on the shotgun, ejecting the spent round and chambering a fresh one.
"Mike!"
the voice in the darkness said one more time. The shotgun erupted again. Pete still in a state of blind panic, his adrenaline pouring through his body. He racked the slide again. Boom! He pumped the slide again. Boom! Pump! Boom!
He continued until there were no more rounds. Behind him, the front porch door opened, and he spun his head toward it, nearly blinded by fear, tears, and adrenaline, but catching himself before he turned the gun in that direction. Ellen came rushing out the door, a pistol in her hand. Pops behind her, with his at the ready.
"What's going on?"
Ellen asked, shining a flashlight onto Pete's chest, illuminating his face. In her panic, she did not realize that this could have made Pete an easy target for any shooters still out there in the darkness. From his panicked expression, she could see that this was no false alarm. She heard the groan of a wounded man in the dark. She started to shine the light toward the sound, but Pete grabbed the light and turned it off. He handed her the night vision monocular from around his neck, all the while pointing his empty shotgun in the direction where he thought the intruders were. In the green glow of the night vision, Ellen could see two men lying in the yard about 30 feet away. One was still. One was moaning and moving around. She dropped the monocular to her chest.
"Oh, Pete," she said,
her voice full of regret and sorrow at what he'd had to do. Pops took the shotgun from Pete. Pete collapsed into his mother's arms, sobbing loudly and holding her tight. She held him for a moment, still worried about the potentially dangerous wounded man. "Go to Pops, baby," she whispered in Pete's ear. "Mommy has to make sure we are safe." She turned on her flashlight and trained it on the two men. Her weapon was raised in the other hand. Occasionally she would sweep both the light and weapon across the yard, making sure there were no other people with them. In a dozen or so steps, she reached the men. She kicked the still one and could tell that if he was not dead now, he would be by morning. There was no response. The other man was conscious, blood pouring from a wound in his stomach. He pressed his hand to it, trying to stem the flow of blood, but there was a hell of a lot of it. It was the rabbit hunter who had been at the gate earlier. "You shouldn't have come here," Ellen said.
"You'll go to jail for this, bitch," the man hissed. "If my family don't get you first."
Ellen could hear crying behind her and knew it was Pete. The emerging man inside Pete had known what he had to do tonight, but the little boy inside of him was having a hard time seeing it before his eyes. Seeing the shotgun in Pete's hand, the man looked at Pete.
"Look what you've done to me, boy," he screeched. "They'll put your mama and you both in jail for this. And if the cops don't take care of her, my brother will. He'll shoot her bitch ass right in front of you."
Ellen dropped her pistol and fired a single shot into the man's head, ending his rant. She'd heard all she was listening to. Pete was having a hard enough time dealing with this. The last thing he needed was to be having to deal with the threat of potential consequences. She knew there would probably be no consequences to a shooting like this under these circumstances, but Pete didn't know that. She mourned for her poor, soft-hearted child. "Stay with them," Ellen told Pops. "I've got to get the tractor." Ellen used the rubber tracks of the excavator to compact the soil over the hole they'd just dug and refilled. Jim had taught her how to use the machine, but she wasn't very efficient at it. Once she had it in place, the digging went quickly. Pete and Pops stood watching. They were in a hollow behind the house, out of sight from everyone but the waning moon. An owl broke the night with his mournful sound. The hole was beneath a feedlot where the neighbor's cattle came to eat. The ground was in a constant state of trampled, muddy carnage. No one would ever know. Chapter 18. It was 5:24 a.m. when my internal clock woke me up. Either that or my bladder, which was ready to explode. I rolled out of the crinkly bed and took shelter behind a nearby tree to take a leak. I wasn't particularly shy, but tried to use my manners occasionally. What I could see of the sky looked clear, giving me hope of a dry day for walking, even if it might be hot and humid. With pressing business attended to, I walked back to our shelter. My legs were stiff from the previous day's walking, and I could tell that I was slightly dehydrated. I lifted my pack from beneath the tarp and sat down against a tree.
We'd been munching candy bars and sucking down water bottles all day yesterday, and I needed to take inventory of my supplies. I was glad that we were drinking up some of the water bottles because I was tired of carrying all that water weight. But the bottled water was too precious to toss out because we needed it to keep going. This was a constant dilemma for the trekker and backpacker. How much water to carry? Too much weighs you down. Too little and you find yourself fighting dehydration. I still had 8 bottles remaining and a few empty bottles that I'd saved for refilling when we found a good water source. I knew Randy had a few more also, and Gary had an unopened 8-pack in addition to what loose bottles he might have accumulated. We could get by on what we had in the bottles today, but may need to start filtering some stream or spring water tomorrow to refill our empties. The Katadyn filter in my pack was more than adequate for keeping us supplied until we got home. It was a veteran of many backcountry trips and had never let me down. Nothing could ruin a backpacking trip faster than spewing from both ends. As far as food went, I had not yet tapped into the emergency food that I kept in my get-home bag, relying instead on what we'd pilfered from the vending machines. In the bottom of my pack was a Chinese knockoff of the MSR pocket rocket that I backpacked with. The knockoff had been less than $10, including shipping from China, and functioned much the same as my MSR stove, except it had a piezo igniter that the MSR didn't have. I had one unused canister of isobutane gas for the stove. It wouldn't be enough for the whole trip, and only served as a backup for times when I couldn't build a fire due to rain or security reasons. I was also carrying a 1-quart pot from an old Coleman backpacking set. I had since replaced it in my primary backpacking gear with a titanium pot that had been a Father's Day present from my wife and kids. This pot was the right size for boiling water for drinking or cooking. It was also the right size that the can of isobutane stove fuel and the stove itself would fit down inside it and allow me room to get the lid on. That protected the whole setup and kept it together in one place. I had some used Gatorade bottles that held the food rations I kept in the pack for shit-hits-the-fan situations, kind of like the one I found myself in now. One held a 2-pound bag of white rice, the other a 2-pound bag of red beans. The bottles were marked in 1-cup increments to make measuring portions easier. There was a large baggie that held a couple of expired Mountain House freezer-dried backpacker meals, 2 MREs that I'd bought at a gun show, and a mixture of various energy and protein bars, in addition to a few drink mixes that could boost electrolytes, provide carbs, or just help cover the taste of bad water. I'd once backpacked a section of the Appalachian Trail around Roan Mountain in Tennessee during a particularly dry summer. Many of the normal watering holes and springs where backpackers traditionally refilled their water had dried up. At one point, I'd become thirsty enough to filter water directly from a leaf-filled mud puddle. I knew the Katadyn would filter out anything unhealthy from the water, but it did nothing to erase the taste of old leaves. I had since started carrying a few drink mixes for that very reason. Even nasty-tasting water can save your life. The stack of candy bars, granola bars, and jerky from the vending machine at the hotel had dwindled. I had divvied up the haul in a tentative fashion soon after the great vending machine heist, giving Gary some to stash in his pack, and during a rest break yesterday I'd given Randy some to stash in her improvised pack so she would have access to fuel when she needed it, without having to ask for it. You can burn several thousand calories a day hiking trails with a pack, and if you don't constantly refuel, you will bonk and reach such a deficit state that you crash and can't continue. We couldn't risk a bonk. I had 9 snacks of different types left from the vending machine. Those would be gone today. I figured Randy had fewer, and I wasn't sure what Gary had. Since no one else was moving yet, I decided to boil up some water and dig into one of the freeze-dried backpacking meals. I needed something besides junk food. After sorting through the stack, I arrived at spinach fettuccine for 2. Not usual breakfast fare, but my only concern at that point was packing calories into my body for the day's trek. Carbs would be great. I set up the stove, poured some water in the cooking pot, and balanced it atop the stove. I took another bottle of water and began attempting to rehydrate myself.
Rather than the soft whisper produced by a gas range, the canister stove sounds like a small jet engine, producing a roar that eventually had Randy and Gary stirring. Murmurs inside Walt and Katie's tent indicated that they were waking up, too.
"Is that garlic I smell?"
Randy asked. "It is," I said. "Guess your sense of smell has not been damaged by all that smoking."
"What the hell are you eating for breakfast that has garlic in it?"
"Spinach fettuccine," I replied. "It's about done. Want some?"
"I don't know," she said hesitantly.
"You'd prefer more candy bars?"
"Fettuccine it is," she replied, sitting up and throwing back her blanket.
Gary got up and raided his own pack for an MRE, although I offered him a third portion of the pasta. Fortunately, I had two plastic sporks in my pack, so Randy and I didn't have to share a utensil. The meals were cooked by pouring boiling water into the bag that the meal comes in, then closing the bag up while the meal rehydrates and cooks. When the correct amount of time has passed, you simply stir the meal and eat it from the bag. Since I didn't have any plates in my pack and didn't want to dirty up the pot, Randy and I passed the bag back and forth alternately until we decimated our spinach fettuccine breakfast.
"Best breakfast pasta I've ever had," Randy said,
digging immediately for a cigarette.
"I think I'd agree," I said.
"What'd you end up with, Gary?"
"Huevos rancheros," he replied. "Real breakfast food."
"I'm eating with him tomorrow," Randy said, winking at me.
Walt and Katie had been packing up their gear while we ate. When they finished, they joined us, each of them nibbling on a Cliff Bar.
"How are you guys set for food?" I asked.
"Getting low," Walt said. "We just come through a 5-day section with no resupply, which is a long stretch for us. We usually don't carry more than 3 days' food. We were planning to resupply today before we changed plans."
"How many meals do you have?"
Walt looked at Katie. She held up a lone finger.
"Lunch," she replied.
I wasn't to the point of singing Kumbaya with these folks yet and telling them that what was mine was theirs. I had a lot of reservations about sharing supplies with everyone I met, potentially depleting them. As her co-workers, Gary and I had already assumed responsibility for helping Randy get home, which would put a dent in our supplies. We had accepted that, though. If we assumed responsibility for everyone we met along the way, we may eventually run out of resources and fail in our mission of getting our own selves home to our families. Feeling a need to address this now that it was hanging out there, I thought of the plan I'd been turning over in my head during our walk yesterday. "I don't have a lot," I said. "I can get you through dinner tonight. We're also facing a resupply issue, though. We don't have enough food to get us home."
"Getting on this trail is the first time I felt safe since leaving Richmond," Randy said. "Don't tell me we're going to have to get off it and go back into the world again, where all the crazy people are."
"Yes, we are," I said. "There's no alternative. You can't travel fast and live off the land. If you're going to travel fast, you need to carry your food with you."
"Are we still shooting for crawfish?" Gary asked.
"Crawfish?" Katie asked. "Your plan is to eat crawfish?"
"No," I said. "Crawfish is a town. My best friend from high school, Lloyd, runs a barber shop in a town on the outskirts of Buena Vista. He's also the mayor. I think he can help us if we can get to his place."
"How far is that?" Katie asked.
"Maybe 35 miles, I responded. "If we can make good time, we can be there tomorrow night."
"You think he'd take us in?" Gary asked. "All of us?"
"I think he will," I said. "There's probably a party at his place right now. He's an old-time musician, and he kind of lives in the past. I doubt any of this has fazed him at all." The day's walk began fairly well, considering the circumstances. I'd always found long walks to be meditative, and it was easy to lose track of time plodding along a mountain trail. I was a little sore that morning, which was a combination of age and pushing it yesterday. Though I was in fairly good shape and did a variety of exercises and activities, hiking is more extreme than people think. My shoulders were sore from the weight of the pack pulling on them. My knees were sore from stabilizing the combined weight of my body and my pack on uneven and hilly terrain. My calves were sore from climbing, as were my quads. My back was stiff from everything combined. The bottom of my forefoot was also hot from a day's walking.
I taped it with duct tape this morning and hoped that it would wear better today. I knew that if I was experiencing all this, the rest had to be in as much pain or worse. I had tried to text my family again and found my iPhone dead. I pulled it from my shirt pocket and checked it again, hoping it had miraculously charged in my sleep, but it had not. While I was staring at it, Gary pulled his from his pocket and checked it also. "Dead," he muttered. "Mine too," I said. He stuck his back in his pocket. Even unreliable communication was better than nothing. "Let's take a short break," I announced to the group. Everyone gladly stopped and dropped their loads for a moment. Usually on backpacking trips, people string out a little based on their individual pace, and then they catch up with each other at the rest breaks. It's no big deal for people to be 30 minutes apart when the path is clearly delineated and there are no hazards or navigational challenges. Due to the unusual circumstances of this particular disaster and the way strangers were not always behaving nicely under the present conditions, I had warned people this morning that I felt it was best to stay within sight of each other as much as possible. I had also told them that if they were pulling off trail to take a bathroom break, they needed to let someone know so we didn't leave them behind. Everyone agreed with the plan. I didn't necessarily consider myself the leader of this bunch, but there were things that needed to be discussed. If no one else brought them up, I would. I dug in my pack and removed a padded nylon case about the size of a hardcover book, around an inch thick. I unfolded the case to the solar cells lining the inside. It was an Anker portable solar charger with a USB port that could charge a phone or tablet. I carried a spare iPhone cable inside the case and plugged it into my phone and then into the charger. Using two carabiners, I hung the charger from the back of my pack so that my phone would charge as I walked. The charger worked best in direct sunlight, but a day of walking should leave it usable by the time we stopped for the day, as long as I could get signal. "That's a trick," Gary said. "I've been wanting one of those." "Start backpacking," I said. "It gives you the excuse to buy a lot of prepper gadgets. My wife would have rolled her eyes at me purchasing this for the apocalypse, but she was fine with me buying it so I could call her and tell her how much I love her from the trail." "I might enjoy backpacking under different circumstances," he said. "Not this girl," Randy said from where she rested against a tree. "I think this will be my one and only backpacking trip. And once I'm home, I may never leave town again." "Can't say I blame you," I remarked. After another candy bar, we hit the trail again. I stared at the empty wrapper before I stuffed it into my pocket, recalling a day when I had looked at a Snickers bar as a treat. I expected it would be a long time before I ever craved another one. I really wanted a club sandwich. We stopped for an early lunch at the empty Blackwood shelter, another of the sparse overnight huts scattered along the trail. Every shelter had a trail register where hikers could sign in with their trail name and indicate they'd been here, and even include a short message if they wanted. There were no entries dated for the previous night. Perhaps word was reaching the trail that things had gone to shit and people were peeling off to try to get home. Come to think of it, we hadn't passed any hikers all day, and that was unusual on the AT. This time of year, it was practically a freeway for the great unwashed and overburdened. Walt and Katie finished the last of their food, sharing sandwiches of tortillas, sliced cheese, and summer sausage. Gary, Randy, and I had jerky, peanuts, and, you guessed it, candy bars. We'd come 13 miles already, but everyone was feeling well. Over the past day, we'd reacted promptly to any hot spots in our shoes, putting duct tape over any areas of our feet that rubbed to prevent blisters. If anyone was suffering, they were hiding it well. I'm a pure mountain masochist. I love to suffer with a pack on. If it hadn't been for the worry about my family, I'd have actually been enjoying this. Thinking about them prompted me to dig out my phone and check it. It had about a 20% charge. This was not surprising, since I'd only had it on charge about 2 hours, and we were in and out of wooded cover all morning. I appreciated that the device worked at all. I had not received any texts since last checking it, but I composed one and sent it to my family, updating them on the turn of events. It balked when I sent it.
The progress bar, refusing to move all the way across, indicating a successfully sent message. I would leave the phone on and on the charger, hoping that it may continue to try to send if we found a pocket of signal along the way. I noticed that Gary had field-stripped his Glock and was wiping sweat from the components with a bandana. I wasn't as Glock-obsessed as Gary, but you had to admire the ease with which he could tear the damn things apart for cleaning.
"I will be adding a gun-cleaning kit to this pack when I get home," he said. I hadn't thought about the effects of daily carry in these conditions.
"They do get nasty," I said. I was gathering my trash to burn in the shelter's fire ring when I saw Walt and Katie staring at Gary. Or more specifically, staring at Gary's Glock. Walt noticed that I was watching him and raised his eyes to meet mine. "We're not big fans of guns," he said. "Guns kill people." I shrugged. "When treated with respect, a gun can be very useful. It's just a tool, and in this case, it's an important survival tool. Our guns have saved our lives several times over the past few days."
"You have one too?"
Katie asked, concern in her eyes and her voice. "I do. And when I hiked the Southwest Virginia section of the AT, the same section you two were just hiking, I carried a gun then too." "They make me uncomfortable," Walt said. A switch inside me flipped, and cold aggression took hold of me. "Would someone raping your girlfriend make you uncomfortable?" Both Walt and Katie recoiled. They hadn't seen this side of me, the unemotional, coldly practical side, the side I'd inherited from my grandfather. This time, however, rather than trying to soften the words and de-escalate the situation, Gary followed my lead.
"You guys haven't seen what it's like out there," Gary said. "It's like Lord of the Flies or some kind of depressing, futuristic movie. Bad people are figuring out that the cops are all occupied with bigger emergencies, and they're doing whatever they want. They're robbing and murdering and raping. We've seen a lot of violence in the last 2 days. Several times, our guns have been all that stood between us and violence."
"You seem like normal people," Katie said. "I'll try not to judge you."
She appeared to be sincere in what she said, but I didn't know her well enough to give a damn if she judged me or not. As much as I wanted Walt and Katie to get home, I wasn't taking on new pains in the asses. I decided I needed to make that clear. "We're glad to help you as long as helping you does not stand in the way of our objective," I said, "which is us three getting home to our families. The minute I feel like you're judging me for doing what I feel I need to do to protect the interests of our group, we'll have to part ways. This is not a democracy. You're welcome to travel with us as long as our interests coincide. When they don't, we part ways with no hard feelings. Is that clear?" Walt and Katie exchanged glances, then met my eyes and nodded.
"I'm sorry if I pissed you off," Katie said, tears in her eyes.
"You didn't piss me off. I'm just a very determined, very blunt man who misses his family."
"The bluntest," Randy agreed.
"No sugarcoating with this guy. He doesn't mind peeing in your cornflakes."
"Definitely not," Gary chimed in.
He reinserted the mag in his Glock, racked the slide to chamber around, and placed the weapon on his pack beside him. I stood and picked up my pack. "As long as we've cleared up who America's biggest asshole is, let's get this show on the road. We're burning daylight." As I shouldered my pack and began buckling the straps, I heard the sound of an engine. I froze and listened. Randy started to say something, but I waved her silent, cupping my ear. In a moment, it was clear. Something motorized was coming up the trail. Gary removed his Glock from the top of his pack and placed it beneath his thighs within easy reach.
"It's a four-wheeler," Randy said quietly.
A green Suzuki ATV came pounding through the brush, overhanging the narrow trail by a foot on each side and leaving a wake of crumpled foliage behind it. It looked incredibly strange and out of perspective. This National Scenic Trail was off-limits to motorized vehicles, and the last thing I expected was one to come crashing out of the woods. It was just another indication of how quickly the world was changing in the wake of disaster. There were two riders. In the front was a scrawny man-boy somewhere between 15 and 25,
wearing a wife-beater, jeans, a gold chain, and hunting boots. He had a faint mustache and a dark mullet. Behind him was a harder-looking man of indeterminate age who bulged with muscles and wore a sleeveless camouflage T-shirt with full sleeves of homemade tattoos. They could be the remnant of jail or merely of a misspent youth. I guessed jail. He had the look of a man who had done hard time. Both carried weapons. The boy in front had a single-shot shotgun hanging over his shoulder from a homemade rope sling. The one in back balanced a lever-action carbine across his lap. When they came within 15 feet of us, they killed their engine. In the silence of the woods, the only sound was the pinging and ticking of their cooling engine. When they stopped in front of me, my eyes were immediately drawn to the front and rear cargo racks of the ATV. Strapped to the racks with bungee cords were two bulging backpacks. We stared at each other, and I broke the ice, nodding at the two. "How's it going?" I asked, hoping to set a friendly tone. The driver nodded back, spat, and met my eye. "All right, I reckon," he said. "You folks camping?" "Nah," I said, "not hardly. Just trying to get home. What are y'all up to?" The two men were no longer meeting my eye, nor were they simply ogling the women as I might have expected. Their eyes moved over us, seeing what we carried, how many packs we had, if we had weapons visible, which we did not. Yet. They were assessing us both as foes and for the potential value of what we might be carrying. "We're doing some hunting," the rider in the back said. "Y'all seen any deer?" His speech was slow, heavily accented, and he wore an inappropriate smile. It was the expression of someone impaired by drugs, or suffering a mental disability, or perhaps even that of a sociopath. I noticed a scar under his eye, and several missing teeth. I shook my head. "No, we haven't seen any deer." "Got a smoke?" he asked. "We're out." I looked around to confirm that Randy wasn't smoking, then replied, "No," I said. "No smokers here." He nodded at me, not saying anything. He continued to look at me, smiling that odd smile, sizing me up. I could feel tension rising. The driver of the ATV wrung his hands on the handlebars, not sure where this was going, not sure if he should stay or drive off. It showed me that the dangerous man, the decision-maker, was the one in back. If this turned violent, my first shot would be aimed at him. It was at this point that the offended liberals in our newly formed group could not contain themselves. "You shouldn't have that four-wheeler on this trail," Walt spat. Apparently, the idea of people hunting on and defacing the trail was too much for him. "Look at what you're doing to the trail. It'll take years for that damage to repair itself." The two riders glanced at each other and grinned, each revealing teeth coated in flecks of smokeless tobacco. They were truly amused by the comment. "What you gonna do?" the rider in back asked. "Tell on us? Who the fuck you gonna tell, college boy?"
"I will if I have to," Walt stammered. "When I get out of here."
Walt raised his cell phone, snapping a quick picture of the man on the ATV, making a big show of collecting evidence. I intervened then, waving an arm toward Walt to hush him up. "He ain't telling on nobody," I said. "You all know as well as we do that there isn't anyone right now who gives a shit if you all hunt up here or not. No one even cares if you ride on the trail now. None of that matters."
"Damn straight," said the man driving the ATV. "Nobody can't do shit about it. You thinking you can do something about it, college boy?"
It was about this point that Walt realized he'd stuck his foot in it, and he started to backpedal.
I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean it."
I rolled my eyes. First, Walt had provoked them, and then he revealed his weakness by folding like a wet noodle. This wasn't going to end well. "Forget him," I said, gesturing at Walt. "He's all talk. We're out of here. Good luck hunting."
"Where y'all headed?"
the passenger asked, his attempt at friendliness chilling my blood. He was definitely a killer.
"West," I said.
The driver gave us all another once-over, then started his engine. He thumbed the throttle and accelerated away,
his passenger giving us a parting nod and a non-committal grin that could have meant just about anything. "We haven't seen the last of those two," I said to no one in particular, as the sound of their engine faded down the trail.
"What do you mean by that?" Walt asked.